answers only. I just sighed and said, "This evening." And that was when a small fleet of ships rose up from the area around Noavek Manor, like bubbles bobbing to the surface of a water glass. They hovered together for a moment, and if the sky had not been so empty, or if they had not borne the Noavek symbol on their wings, I might not have noticed them at all. But those were Lazmet Noavek's ships, and they were headed straight west, toward the Divide, toward Thuva. "The anti-current blast will happen this evening," I said. Everyone sat on the main deck of the transport vessel. Most were on the bench along one wall, where the straps for buckling ourselves in dangled from the wall, but Tekka was on the steps leading up to the nav deck, and Issa was in the captain's chair, fiddling with the ship's map. My racing current shadows, and the pain that chased them back and forth across my body, didn't allow me such stillness. I paced. "Yes," I just said. "Visions don't come with a watch, so the timing is not exact, but based on the color of the light, it will be evening." I squinted at him. "Is that the truth, or is that just something you're telling me to manipulate me into doing what you want?"
"Are you really going to believe my answer to that question?"
"No." I stopped for a moment, in front of him. "Why now? You've only ever cared about yourself for your entire life. So what's gotten into you? Brain parasite?" "Is that really constructive?" Tekka said. "We should be figuring out how to save as many lives as possible, which means activating the emergency evacuation alert again."
"Evacuation protocol is to flee toward the Sojourn ship," I said.
"Where would people go if we sounded that alarm?" "I can code the alarm with a message. That way, people with screens in their homes will at least know what's coming," Tekka said. "We can tell them to just get out of the city whatever way they can."
"And the people who don't have screens in their houses?" Etrek said. "The people who barely have lights to turn on? What about them?"
"I didn't say it was perfect," she scowled at him. "And I don't hear you suggesting anything useful."
"If we do this," Ema said to Tekka, "we may not be able to flee ourselves. We may die here."
A silence fell at that. I had accepted the likelihood of death when I decided to kill my father, but now that I had my life, I wanted to keep it again. Even without Akos, even without family, even with most of Shotet hating me, what I had told Tekka before was right. I had more now. I had friends, hope for my own future, and for myself. But I also had love for my people, broken though some of them may have been. Their stubborn will to survive. The way they looked at discarded objects, not as garbage, but as possibilities. They crash-landed through hostile atmospheres. They coasted alongside the current stream. They were explorers, innovators, warriors, wanderers. And I belonged to them.
"Yeah," I said. "Let's do it."
"How?"
Issa asked.
"Where do you activate the alarm?"
"One of two places, Noavek Manor and the amphitheater." "The amphitheater is easier to access," I said.
"We don't all need to go. So who goes and who stays?"
"I'm leaving this planet," I just said.
"Yeah, I got that impression based on your repeated insistence that you're not staying," I snapped.
"I will take you off planet, Aija," Issa said to him. "You are an oracle, and as such, your life is valuable."
"My life's not valuable?"
Etrek said. Issa gave him a look.
"You two should go," I said to Zeet.
You only signed on to smuggle, not to risk your lives.
Yeah, none of us here would ever do that, Etrek said, rolling his eyes. You remember most of us came here to kill Lazmet Noavec, right?
I glanced at Tekka and Sifa in turn. You're an oracle too, I said to Sifa.
I'm not afraid, Sifa said quietly.
I was. Part of me wanted to steal a floater and flee Voa as quickly as I could, get myself out of the way of the blast. But the better part, the part that made the decisions now, it seemed, knew that I had to stay, had to fight for my people, or at least allow them a chance to fight for themselves. And maybe Sifa was as undaunted as she appeared. Maybe knowing the future forced you to be at peace with it. But I didn't think so. She was afraid, just as I was, just as any person would be. It was that, perhaps, that made me accept that she was here. It was the most mercy I could offer her at the moment.
Syra should lead the way to the amphitheater, Ema said,
and I looked at her in surprise. It was rare she gave me credit for anything, ever. She added,
I believe you're familiar with the subterranean prison.
Not as familiar as I am with your dazzling wit, I bit back with a smile.
You take the bait every time, don't you? Tekka said to me.
I considered that for a moment.
Yes, I said. It's part of my charm.
Etrek snorted. And we started to plan. Sometime later, we stood on the rooftop and watched Aija and Issa board a smuggler ship, courtesy of Zeet's connections to Voa's criminal underground. Aija didn't bid me farewell, but he did glance back before disappearing inside the ship. His eyes met mine, and he nodded, just once. And then my brother was gone.
Chapter 51, Akos. The awakening in Hessa had never been Akos's favorite. He liked the quiet dark of the deadening with its warm ovens and bright, bloomed hush flowers, but it had certain charms. At the very start, in the weeks before the hush flowers lost their blooms, a swarm of dead birds flew over Hessa every morning and evening in a big cloud, whistling in unison. Their song was bright and sweet, and the undersides of their wings were pink like Akos's blush. They were called dead birds because they hibernated all winter, and the first person to come across a flock during hibernation had thought they were all dead. They hardly even had heartbeats then. And when the awakening came around, they flew all the time, dropping pink feathers everywhere. His dad collected them for his mom, and stuck them in a jar on the kitchen table for decoration. When Lazmet Noavec's ship landed just past the feather grass north of Hessa, it sent up a cloud of pink feathers. At least they aren't going past the house, Akos thought. His family's home was far from where they landed, though along the same strip of feather grass. They would approach Hessa Hill from behind, where there were no houses, and steps carved from rock would lead them to the temple's back gate. The Shotet groaned and shivered when the hatch of the ship opened. Even Lazmet seemed to brace himself. But Akos drank in the frozen air like it was the finest thing he'd ever tasted. The soldiers had laughed at him when he first came on board, stuffed into half a dozen sweaters and jackets, incapable of lowering his arms, but none of them were laughing now. Akos pulled the strip he had torn from his blanket over his face, so only his eyes showed. He spotted the handle of a current blade on a careless soldier's hip and wondered if he could grab it, stab Lazmet right now before anyone attacked Hessa. But the soldier turned away, the opportunity disappearing. Lazmet beckoned, and Akos went to the front of the pack that had come together, the soldiers drawing closer in the cold. Vakrez and Lazmet, at least, had put on more than one layer. Akos went to the front of the group and looked up at Hessa Hill. He had told Lazmet to fly in from as far north as he could stand to go, to glide low next to the feather grass and park, going in on foot. Sure enough, he didn't hear the sirens that would have sounded all throughout the town if somebody had seen Chotet's soldiers. It was strange how he hoped that he would succeed and hoped that he would fail all at once. There were two paths to the bottom of the hill, one that went into a dip in the land and would protect them from rough wind, and another that wouldn't. Akos chose the latter. He hoped half of the soldiers froze to death on their way in, or at least got such cold fingers they couldn't handle their current blades right. Akos pointed his nose across the bare plains and started walking. It wasn't a long enough walk for any of the Chotet soldiers to freeze to death, unfortunately. But by the time they got to the bottom of the hill, the people behind him had come up with their own strategies for staying warm, some better than others. They were chewing on their fingertips, not the best idea, or wrapping their hands and faces in handkerchiefs and cloths. They were huddled in groups, rotating so one person took the brunt of the wind at a time. Akos's eyelashes were frosted, and the skin around his eyes was numb, but he felt all right otherwise. The trick to walking in the cold was to just let the chill happen, trusting that your body would take care of itself. When the will to live failed, the body still fought. The wind died down. They were shielded now by huge crags made by avalanches and natural promontories, since this was the jagged side of Hessa Hill. Still, finding the steps wasn't easy. You had to know where they were, and Akos's memory, dulled though it was by everything he'd done, held strong. He went around one of the bigger rock formations, and there they were, faint indentations only as long as the ball of his foot.
"I thought you said there were steps," Vakrez said to him.
"I thought you said the Chotet were adaptable," Akos retorted, his voice muffled by fabric, and he started up the slope. Lazmet insisted that Akos lead the way, which ruled out shoving him over the edge. Akos started the quick hop that made the steps easier to climb, only he couldn't do it. He had been deprived of food for too long to do so much as a single bounce. He slumped against the side of the hill. More of a mountain to the Chotet, he realized, to keep him balanced as he went.
"You starve him for weeks, and now you want him to lead us up a mountain?" Vakrez said to Lazmet.
"Get up there and help him then, if you're so concerned," Lazmet said. Vakrez stepped past Lazmet and, avoiding Akos's eyes, put an arm across Akos's back. Akos was startled by how strong Vakrez was, the older man lifting him almost to his toes as they walked together on the narrow stairs. The wind wailed so loud Akos couldn't have heard him if he had whispered right in his ear, so the two men climbed in silence, Vakrez pausing every time he noticed Akos's breaths getting labored. After a while, the steps got bigger and flatter, cutting a winding path into the mountainside. They were made for oracles, not athletes, after all. The sun was setting, and the snow sparkled in the light, glinting as it blew across the stone. It was a simple enough sight, and one Akos had seen thousands of times growing up, but he'd never loved it as much as he did then, at the helm of a group of invading soldiers on the verge of murder. It was over too soon. They made it to the top, where a few sparse trees covered their approach, bent and curled from the constant wind. Akos had to stop at the top step, and Lazmet waved the others toward the door as Vakres held him upright. He was just standing on his own again when Vakres pivoted, his broad frame shielding Akos from Lazmet's view.
"Whoa," Vakres said. "Get your legs under you, boy."
And he hiked up some of Akos's layers, shoving a blade under the waistband of Akos's pants and covering the handle with a sweater.
"Just in case,"
Vakres said so quietly it was almost lost to the wind. Akos didn't intend to use a blade, but he appreciated the gesture regardless. The smell of Hessian incense nearly made Akos fall apart. It was herbal, almost like the medicine his mom had force-fed him for his chronic cough when he was a kid, but not quite, and spicy, stinging his nose once it wasn't numb from the cold anymore. It smelled like a dozen bloomings, and handfuls of after-school visits spent waiting for Sifa to be done meeting with someone in the Hall of Prophecy, and afternoons of snickering at the youngest Oblates, who stared at Ija and blushed right after he grew from a child to a teenager. It smelled like home. Akos joined the soldiers in shedding some of his outer layers, though he was careful to protect the blade Vakres had given him every time he raised his arms. He wound up in just one sweater, dark blue and soft, and kept his multiple pairs of socks on. They were keeping his two large boots where they were. Sweat dotted the back of his neck. He felt warm air on it when he took off his hat. His legs still felt like jelly from the climb, or maybe that was anticipation of what was next.
"You'll want to disable the power in the building before you do anything else," he said to Lazmet. "There's the main power source and a backup generator. Take the bulk of your soldiers to the main source. It's on the other side of the building, and you'll run into temple guards that way. The backup generator is close, and nobody guards it."
He took out the crude map he'd drawn of the temple. Just the path from the back door to the maintenance room in the basement was marked on it, and stuffed it into Lazmet's hand.
"You only labeled one of those two on here," Lazmet said, looking the map over.
"Yeah," Akos said. "I have to keep some things back, or I can't hold you to your end of the deal. I'll take you to the backup generator myself."
He wasn't surprised when Lazmet didn't get angry. That would have been a normal response. You get in a person's way at a crucial moment and they get angry. But Lazmet wasn't normal. He wanted his world to interest him, and Akos, thinking two steps ahead, clearly did. This must have been how he crafted Rizek, Akos thought. His disapproval came in the form of horror after horror, eyeballs in jars and people lying on their own blades. But when a person did finally make him proud, even if the reason disgusted them, they wanted to do it again. And again, and again.
"Commander Nolovic, you'll take the platoon to the main power source. You and you?"
He pointed to two soldiers. One dark-skinned, his coarse hair pulled back, and the other slim and yellow-haired, her skin almost as pale as Akos's.
"You'll come with us."
It wouldn't be easy to get this done with two soldiers with them, Akos knew. But there was nothing he could do about it. No way he could insist that Lazmet come with him alone without making the man suspicious. If he had to get them all killed, he would. He had already gone crashing through his own ethics in every possible way. What was another mark on his arm? The cool metal of Vakres's blade pressed to Akos's back as he walked. He led the small group down a stone hallway, past the memorial of oracles past, where a long line of names were etched into a flat slab of stone. His mother wouldn't write her own until she foresaw her own death, which was the curse all oracles had to bear. At the end of the hallway was a lantern that glowed faint pink, the result of faded hushflower powder. He turned right there, guiding them away from the Hall of Prophecy. He thought it was safe, leading them through the dormitories of the Oblates who lived at the temple, but he had miscalculated. At the end of the row of doors was a young woman with her hair piled high on her head, yawning as she tugged her sweater back over her shoulder. Their eyes met. Akko shook his head, but he was too late. Lazmet had already seen her. "Don't let her run," he said, sounding bored. The yellow-haired soldier streaked past Akos with her blade outstretched. Black strings of current wrapped around her clenched fist. She thrust with one arm and caught the girl with the other. A sick, gurgling sound came out of her mouth, a scream aborted before it could even take shape. Akko shuddered. "Tell me your mission," he repeated to himself as he tasted bile. "To kill Lazmet Noavec." "Stay here," Lazmet said to the soldier in a quiet voice. "Make sure she doesn't make noise, and that no one else interferes." Swallowing hard, Akos kept going, past the girl, wheezing now with what was left of her life, and the soldier wiping her bloody blade on the seat of her pants. It was a clear night, so the moon, still rising to its full height, glowed through the narrow windows they passed. There were still scars in the stone walls from the Shotet siege that happened before Akos was born. He remembered running his fingers over them when he was a kid, stretching high over his head to touch the violence he hadn't yet seen. That violence lived in his blood, not because he was a Shotet, but because he was a Noavec. The great-grandfather who had been a mediocre blacksmith and a vicious killer. The grandmother who had murdered her own siblings. The father who put a vice around the city of Voa. The brother who twisted and warped Aija. It would end here. Now. Akos reached the door he was looking for, had been looking for since they first landed. It didn't lead to a backup generator. There was no backup generator for the temple, a fact that had caused trouble during more than one snowstorm, forcing them to host a small pack of oblets in their house until the wind died down. No. This door led to the courtyard where the hush flowers grew. A small field of deadly poison, right there in the temple. Akos opened it, gesturing Lazmet inside. "After you," he said. Akos stepped in front of the soldier before he could follow Lazmet into the courtyard, bringing the door swinging behind him. The move had surprised the man. He didn't even object as Akos slammed the door between them and turned the bolt so he couldn't get in. "If your intention was to trick me into poisoning myself, your timing is off," Lazmet said. Akos turned. The hush flowers, the ones he had been counting on to make this easier, their poison blooms capable of felling Lazmet even if he, Akos, couldn't, weren't there. Their stalks were empty. The flowers had already been harvested. The knife was still cool against Akos's back. If Vakras hadn't given it to him, he would be as good as dead right now. Lazmet spread his hands, gesturing to all the dying leaves that surrounded him. He stood in the middle of the narrow path of stone that ran through the courtyard to keep the caretakers away from the death-giving blossoms. Hushflower leaves died off in the peak of the awakening when the weather was warmest, though the roots stayed viable for a lifetime if cared for properly. So all the greenery around Akos's father was limp and smelled like rot and dirt, ready to lie fallow until the next bloomin'. There was no poison left to kill Lazmet with. "That's inconvenient," Akos said. "But I do have a backup plan." He lifted his shirt and drew Vakras's current blade. "Vakras. Now that's a surprise. I didn't think his heart had gone that soft in my absence," Lazmet said. His voice had lost the unctuous quality it usually had when he spoke to Akos, like he was resorting to sing-song with a stubborn kid. This was not the Lazmet who found him amusing. It was the one who forced people to cut out their own eyes. "I will have to punish him as soon as I am finished with you." He was folding the cuffs of his sleeves over, one turn after another, so they stayed up by his elbows. "Tell me, Akos," Lazmet said. "How do you believe this will go for you? You are starved, exhausted, and picking a fight with a man who can control every movement of your body. There is no chance you will emerge from this place alive." "Well," Akos said, "get on with killing me then." He felt the squeeze around his head that meant Lazmet's current gift was trying to worm its way in, searching out weak points. But Akos was the armored one, and there was no getting past his current gift. He started toward Lazmet, crushing leaves under his boots as he went. He knew better than to delay any longer. Before the full weight of the situation could hit Lazmet, Akos swung. His arm collided with Lazmet's armored wrist. Akos gasped from the pain of the collision, but didn't relent. He was back in the arena. Only there was no jeering crowd this time. No Suzao Kuzar thirsting for his blood. Just the grit of Lazmet's teeth in the dark, and Syra's lessons echoing in his head, telling him to think, to abandon thoughts of honor, to survive. He felt the pressure of Lazmet's current gift again, bearing down harder on both sides of his skull. They broke apart. Lazmet wore armor on both wrists, chest, back. He would have to aim low or high. Akos bent, rushing at his father like he meant to tackle him, and stabbing low at his legs. He felt a line of heat across the back of his neck as his own knife carved into Lazmet's thigh. Lazmet had cut him. He ignored the blood coursing down his back, soaking his shirt, and the pulse of pain. Lazmet was groaning, clutching his leg with one hand. "How?" the man growled. Akos didn't answer. He felt unsteady, the weeks of limited food catching up with him. Not everything could be buried under adrenaline. He followed his stumbling toward Lazmet again, using the unpredictability of his movement to his advantage, the way Syra had when, suffering from severe blood loss, she had to fight Aija in the arena. As his world tilted, so did he, and he thrust up at Lazmet's throat. Lazmet grabbed his arm and yanked it hard to the side. Pain sparked in Akos's shoulder and spread through his entire body. He screamed, and the knife fell out of his hands and into the rotten leaves. He fell down too, lying at Lazmet's feet. Tears rolled down the sides of his face. All this planning, all this lying, the betrayal of his friends, his family, his country, Syra, and it had come to this. "You aren't the first son to try to kill me, you know," Lazmet said. He lifted his foot and pressed it to the joint of Akos's injured shoulder. Even just the touch of the man's boot made Akos scream again, but he stepped down harder, slowly putting all his weight into it. Akos's vision went black, and he fought to stay present, to stay conscious, to think. He wished he had thought to ask Syra how she did it, kept thinking in the midst of pain, because to him it felt impossible. All that was left of him were the white-hot sparks of agony. Lazmet leaned closer, not moving his foot.
Rizek surprised me too, while we sojourned together. Our holiest of rites, the scavenge, and he dared to attack me, imprison me.
Lazmet paused, his jaw working.
But I didn't die then. Rizek was too weak, and I'm not going to die now, am I?
He twisted his toe like he was squashing a particularly stubborn bug. Akko screamed again, tears running into his hair, wrapping around his ears. He heard a distant wail, the Hesse siren going off, summoning the army to arms. It was too late for him, too late for the oblate in the hallway and the temple of Hesse. This moment had all the heft of fate in it. The weight of inevitability, set in motion from the moment Vara the Oracle told him his Kyrta, his life-altering truth. The revelation of his parentage hadn't released him from the future. It had guided him to it, pulling him to his father's side like a fish hooked through the lip.
"Suffer the fate," his mother's voice said to him. "For all else is delusion."
He understood now how Syra had felt when she demanded that he choose her, even though he hadn't known at the time that he really could.
"I don't want to be something you suffer," she had told him. There was something powerful in that quality of hers. Her refusal to accept what she didn't choose, the force of her want.
"I don't want," she had said, and he felt it now. He didn't want this to be the end, the fate he suffered. And in the muddle of all that pain, Akos thought. He pulled his knee high up against his chest and kicked hard at the wound in Lazmet's leg. Lazmet grunted, taken by surprise, and let up just a little on Akos' shoulder. With a yell, Akos pushed against the ground with his free leg so his back scraped against the ground, half on the leaves and half on the stone path, and he stretched his uninjured arm up, his hand searching through the stems for Vakrez's knife. Lazmet had stepped back, grabbing his leg with one hand. Akos felt the metal of the knife handle and grabbed. He felt his pulse in his throat, his head, his shoulder, and trembling and throbbing and sagging under his own weight, he pushed himself to his feet. It wasn't fate that had brought him here. He had chosen this. He had wanted it. And now he wanted Lazmet dead. The Hesse siren wailed. He and Lazmet collided, armor against flesh. They went down, falling with a thump to the frozen ground and the waxy leaves. Akos felt another burst of pain in his shoulder and dry heaved, his stomach too empty to throw anything up. Their arms were crossed between them, both of Lazmet's hands around his wrist, trying to push the knife away.
Honor, Akos thought, has no place in survival.
He bent his head and bit Lazmet's arm. He clenched his teeth as hard as he could, tasting blood, tearing flesh. Lazmet screamed low. Akos pushed the knife against the pressure that held him away and jerked his head, ripping skin and muscle from Lazmet's arm. The knife went right into Lazmet's neck. Everything stopped.
Asa Kariseth had broken things with his current gift. Floater seats, couch cushions, tables, mugs, plates. One time he broke one of Akos's toys by mistake.
and sat his smallest child in his lap to show him how he could fix it, like magic, with the same gift that had broken it. The toy had never looked right again, but Ausa had done his best. He had chased their mother around the kitchen with flour-dusted hands to put fingerprints on her clothes. He was the only one who could make Sifa laugh, a full belly laugh. The one who had kept her present and grounded, at least as much as that was possible for an oracle. Ausa Karaseth had been loud and messy and affectionate. He had been Akos's father. And this man, this armored, cold, cruel man lying an arm's length away, wasn't. Akos lay beside Lazmet as he died, holding the arm his father had wounded to his chest, and finally wanting again. It was a small thing, just a slight craving for survival, but it was better than nothing.
Chapter 52. Syra. I ran my fingers over the silver skin on my head. It had begun to generate electrical impulses similar to those of real nerves, so I could feel a light tapping where my touch was. It was soothing, like standing under the warm rain of Pitha.
"Quit it, platehead," Tekka said. "You're drawing attention."
We stood in the square just outside the amphitheater. Under the reign of my brother, this place would have been packed with vendors, some from other planets, forbidden from instructing us in the use of their languages, of course, and some Shotet. The air would smell like smoke and charred meat and the burnt herbs from the tents of Asander, where everyone seemed particularly attuned to scents. I would tuck my hands into my sleeves to keep from touching anyone, fearing the crush of the crowd. My brother had been a tyrant as much as Lazmet was, but part of him had craved adoration, and it had inspired him to make concessions on occasion. Lazmet had no such craving. In light of that, the square was not packed with people shouting numbers at each other. Soldiers didn't stroll between the stalls, hoping to catch someone speaking a word of another language so they could extort money or threaten punishment. There were a few tables set up with goods, food, mostly, marked up to high prices, and all of them were Shotet. I doubted many outsiders wanted to be in a country involved in war, profitable though it might have been. "It's less of a plate and more of a bowl," I said to Tekka, holding my hands in a curved shape, like that of my skull.
"What?"
"The silver skin," I said, showing her my hands again. "If it's any kind of serveware, it's a bowl, not a plate."
"I didn't mean plate as in dinner plate," Tekka said, scowling. "I meant it as in a metal plate, like on the side of a ship. You know what? This is ridiculous." "You're ridiculous."
I grinned. I thought we would suffer for the lack of a crowd to disguise us, but there were few soldiers that I could see. Guards by the usual entrances and exits, but they were easily dealt with. And not in my typical fashion, though that had been my initial suggestion. Sifa had proposed a more peaceful path into the amphitheater. She and Ima would approach the guards at the entrance head-on and convince them to let her tour the arena. Ima had worn the lavender dress for the occasion, so she would look wealthy, important, worth making allowances for. This would draw the guards' attention away from us, while also giving Ima and Sifa a chance to get in themselves. Zeet and Etrek had pledged to create some kind of large distraction near the side door to draw away the guards there. Tekka and I had to enter through that door while the guards dealt with whatever Etrek and Zeet did. We were too easily recognized. "There she goes," I said to Tekka, nodding to the entrance with its grand archway. Ima's lavender skirt fluttered in the wind. She drew her shawl tighter around her shoulders
and began walking through the square. I had passed through the amphitheater's arch on my way to challenge my brother. It had been simpler then. A single enemy, a single path forward. Now, there were tyrants and chancellors and exiles, and countless factions among the people who served each of them. And there was Akkos. Whatever that meant.
Sifa said he's not here, Tekka said to me, like a mind reader. Lazmet took him wherever they went. I know that's not all that reassuring, but better for him not to be hit by the blast, right?
It was. It meant that I could think clearly, but I didn't want to admit to that. I shrugged.
I asked her for you, Tekka said. I knew you'd be too proud to do it yourself.
Time to go, I said, ignoring her. We started through the square, keeping pace with Sifa, who was doing her part to look casual and familiar. She paused at one of the tables to look over a platter of pan-fried feathergrass. Tekka and I kept to the next row, watching her through the haze of smoke rising up from the smithy advertising free current blade repairs with purchase. I watched Sifa and Ima approach the entrance guard from a distance. I was sure Ima's tongue could be just as quick and persuasive as she needed to get into that amphitheater. She had spent her life lying, after all. When the guards were both engaged enough to turn away, I led the way to the side door at a brisk walk. It was set into the wall at an angle, creating a space for a guard to stand without being visible from the street. I drew my current blade. The soldier was young and tall, so for a moment I saw Akkos in his stead, putting on his Shotet armor for the first time and appearing, to me, as the exact image of what I might have wanted if I had been allowed to want normal things. But in the next moment, the soldier was shorter, thinner, and lighter-haired. Not Akkos. Just before I could lash out at him, I heard screaming behind me. At the edge of the square, a cloud of smoke had risen up from one of the stalls. No, not a cloud of smoke, but one of insects, all taking flight at once. The screams came from the vendor, losing all of his product at once. He lunged at Zeet, who was laughing, and punched him hard in the jaw. I sheathed my current blade and said, "Guard!" The sandy-haired guard stepped out of his alcove to look at me. "There's a fight," I said, jabbing my thumb over my shoulder. "Not again," he groaned and took off running. Tekka slipped in without ceremony, drawing the small screwdriver from its place in her pocket and addressing the lock on the door. I peered out at the square to make sure no one was watching us. There were only slumped vendors and furtive-looking Shotet making their purchases, and the growing brawl Zeet and Etrek had fostered.
"Hello, darling," Tekka said softly in the voice she used to speak to wires. "Would you open up for me? No, not your job? Ah."
I heard a click. The door opened, and Tekka and I passed through the doorway. It locked automatically behind us, and some instinct in me told me that wasn't good for quick escapes, but there was nothing to be done about it now. We jogged down the dark hallway with its arched stone ceiling, toward the light at the end that would admit us to the bottom level of seats. Sifa was already walking the arena floor, cooing like a bird at how large the place was, and how it never seemed as big when she was sitting in the audience, and whatever else she could think of to say. Her voice, with its slight, rough character, echoed a dozen times over even before we made it to the end of the hallway. Ima was beside her, making little hums of assent. Tekka immediately started up the steps toward the control room, which was behind the second-level seats, but I stayed at the low wall that separated the first row from the arena floor and closed my eyes. I could hear the chanting that had accompanied the edge of Rizek's knife as it dug into me, the shouts of traitor that had met me when I challenged him again.
Syra?
Tekka's voice pulled me free from the twists and turns of my memory. I opened my eyes as the sky darkened. It could have been something as ordinary as a cloud passing over the sun, but it had already been cloudy when I closed my eyes, an even pale gray in every direction. Instead, when I lifted my head, I saw a vast ship, far larger than any transport vessel or floater or military craft that Shotet possessed. It was as large as the Sojourn ship, but perfectly round, more like the Thuvazit passenger floater that Sifa had guided into the Renegade safe house. The underside of the ship was smooth and polished, like it had never been flown before, never been battered by space debris and asteroids and rough atmospheres. Dotting its belly were little white lights. They marked doors and hatches, important attachment points and docking stations, and the ship's massive outline. It was an Otherian craft. I was sure of it. No one else would have the will and the vanity to make something so functional, so beautiful.
Syra?
Tekka's voice again, fearful this time. I locked eyes with Sifa, standing in the center of the arena. Aija had decided the time of his vision based on the color of the light, he said. Well, with this ship shielding Voa from the sun, it looked very much like dusk. The attack was happening now.
I wouldn't bother with the control room, I said, surprised by how remote my own voice sounded to me.
The soldiers who had shown Sifa into the arena fled, as if they could outrun a ship that large before the anti-current blast hit. And perhaps there was no shame in that, in dying with hope. I hoisted myself over the barrier that separated me from the arena, and dropped neatly to the packed earth below. I didn't know why, except that I didn't want to be standing above the arena when the anti-current blast hit. I wanted to be where I belonged. Here, with grit in the soles of my boots, where people who loved to fight stood. And I loved to fight. But I also loved to live. I wouldn't say I had never thought of dying as some kind of relief when the pain was at its worst, when I lost my true mother to the darkness I didn't yet understand. And I wouldn't say that living was always, or even often, a pleasant experience for me. But the discovery and rediscovery of other worlds, the burn and ache of muscles building strength, the feeling of Akos's warm, strong body against mine, the glint of my mother's decorative armor at night in the Sojourn ship. I loved them all. I stopped in the middle of the arena, within grasp of Sifa and Ima, but not touching them. I heard Tekka's light footfalls behind me.
Well, Tekka said, I suppose it could be worse.
I would have laughed if it had been any further from the truth. But for Tekka and Ima and me, who had come so close to other, far more horrible ways of dying, I supposed dissolving into an anti-current blast was not so bad.
Anti-current, I murmured, because the word seemed so strange to me.
I looked at Sifa, at my mother, in whatever way she still was that, and for the first time, she looked genuinely surprised.
I don't understand. Anti-current blasts are light, I said. The Sojourn ship, it was so bright when it was destroyed. How can anti-current be bright.
The current is both visible and invisible, Sifa said. It doesn't always appear to us in a way that we understand.
I frowned down at my spread palms, where the current shadows had collected, winding again and again around my fingers like stacks of rings. The doctor I had seen as a child had suggested that my current gift came about because I thought I deserved pain, and that everyone else deserved it too. My mother, Ilira Noavec, had chafed at the mere suggestion.
This is not her fault, she had said, before dragging me out of the office.
And Akos, when he had seen the way I kept track of what I had done on my arm, now covered, as always, by armor, he had simply asked me, "How old were you?" He had not thought this gift was what I deserved, and neither had my mother. And maybe they were both right. Maybe the doctor was the one who had been wrong, the man whose words had been echoing in my mind all my life. Maybe pain was not my current gift. Not at all. Maybe pain was just a byproduct of something else. If the anti-current was light, and I was plagued by dark, maybe current was my gift.
She is herself a small Ogre,
the Ogryn dancers had said to me when they saw my current gift displayed.
Does anyone know what the word Ogre actually means in Ogryn? I said.
It means the living dark, Sifa replied.
I laughed, a little, and as a narrow hatch opened on the underside of the ship above us, I raised my shadow-stained hands to the sky. I pushed my current shadows up, 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 over the sizzle of the amphitheater's force field, which Akos had disabled at a touch as he lifted us to safety. His arm had been strong across my back, tightly coiled as a rope. Over the center of Voa, where I had lived all my life, contained in spotless wood paneling and the glow of Fenzu. I felt Rizek's hands, a little sweaty as they pressed over my ears, to shield me from the screams of whoever my father was tormenting. And higher, over Voa, over even the fringes of the city where the storyteller and his sweet purple tea lived, where the renegades had cobbled together a dinner table made of half a dozen other dinner tables. I didn't suffer from a lack of fuel. The current shadows had been so strong all my life, strong enough to render me incapable of attending a simple dinner party, strong enough to bow my back and force tears from my eyes, strong enough to keep me awake and pacing all through the night, strong enough to kill. But now I understood why they killed. It wasn't because they drained the life from a person, but because they overwhelmed it. It was like gravity. We needed it to stay grounded, alive, but if it was too strong, it formed a black hole from which even light could not escape. Yes, the force of the current was too fierce for one body to contain. Unless that body was mine. My body, battered again and again by soldiers and brothers and enemies, but still working its way upright. My body, a channel for the pure force of current, the hum-buzz of life that brought others to their knees. Life is full of pain, I had told Akos, trying to draw him back from depression. Your capacity for bearing it is greater than you believe. And I had been right. I had had every reason to become closed off, wrapped up tight, pushing everything that resembled life and growth and power as far away from myself as possible. It would have been easier that way, to refuse to let anything in. But I had let Akos in,
trusting him when I had forgotten how to trust. And I had let Tekka in, too. And maybe one day, Sifa, I would let anyone in who dared draw near. I was like the planet Agra, which welcomed anyone and anything that could survive life close to it. Not because I deserved pain, and not because I was too strong to feel it, but because I was resilient enough to accept it as an inevitability. My current shadows shot up, up, up. They spread, building from the tendrils around my fingers to a column in the sky that wrapped my entire body in shadow dark. I couldn't see Tekka or Sifa or Ima now, but I saw the great pillar of current that passed over and through me toward that hatch that had opened in the Otherian ship above. I didn't see the anti-current weapon, whatever its container looked like, but I did see the blast. The light spreading out from one fixed point, just as the shadow stretched upward from me. And where they collided. Agony. I screamed, helplessly, as I had not screamed since I was too young to remember. The pain was so intense it shattered my pride, my reason, my sense of self. I heard the screaming and felt the scraping feeling of my own voice in my throat and the inferno inside me and around me, and saw the shadow and the light and the space where they met with a sharp clap. My knees buckled, and arms wrapped around my waist, thin, bony ones. A head pressed between my shoulder blades, and I heard Tekka's voice saying, "Hold on, hold on, hold on." I had killed her uncle, her cousin, and in some ways, her mother. And still she stood behind me, keeping me upright. Hands wrapped around my arms, warm and soft, and the smell of sendus leaf floated over to me. The scent of Sifa's shampoo. The dark eyes of the one who had abandoned me, and now returned for me. And last, the strict, pale fingers of Ima Zetsivus on my wrist. The current moved through all of us at once. My friend, my enemy, my mother, and me, all wrapped together in the darkness that was life itself. 5. Arzode. Verb. In Zolden. To mar. As with a knife.
Chapter 53. Sizi. Breaking news, the screen says. Lazmet Noavek confirmed dead in Shotet assault on Hessa, major city of Thuva. I look the nurse steadily in the eye. I want to tell her that I don't care if my intestines are spilling out on the floor. She will get me a wheelchair, and she will clear me to fly with Issei Benazit to Thuva. But of course I can't say that. Other people's current gifts falter when their bodies weaken, but not mine, apparently. Instead, I search for what might persuade her. The usual Otherian things. Fine fabrics, don't seem like the right choice. She's too hard-nosed for that. She's not someone who has let herself long for things. She would take comfort in something she can access, like a hot bath or a comfortable chair. Water is easy for me, so I send it toward her. Not the rolling waves that would work on Issei, but the still warmth of someone soaking, buoyant and motionless. I don't bother with subtlety. I fill the room with it. My cheeks heat and my stomach aches from the stitches that still hold my guts in. I'm from Hessa, I say, and it feels muffled, even though I can hear myself clearly. One of the oddities of my gift. I need to go. Clear me. she's nodding, blinking dully at me. I haven't spoken to Issei since Ast's arrest. She came to assure me that it was done, that he was gone. Since